Hello, and welcome to the Farmers I Know podcast. I'm Carolyn Hirshon. This is the show dedicated to conversations with the people growing food to nourish their communities. This is a special episode all about water. There's a reason astronauts are obsessed with finding water on other planets. Water indicates life is possible. We know how important it is, we drink it every day, but it's kind of like the air we breathe or the ground we walk on. Unless there's something out of the ordinary, we don't necessarily put a lot of thought into it. Farmers don't have that luxury. Their reliance on water extends beyond keeping their bodies going. It's a critical component of their work. Not enough or too much can have detrimental impacts that can make or break the year. Maybe you think that's just a farmer problem. But it's all of our problem, because we rely on farmers to grow our food. Of course, it's not just farmers that put a lot of thought into water. It's also conservationists and water defenders and activists working to remind everyone of our dependence on this precious and powerful resource. I met my first guest at a Mishoon burn in southern Massachusetts that my friend invited me to. A Mishoon burn is an indigenous tradition where a log is slowly burned and carved into a canoe over a long period of time. People cook on it and camp out and take turns tending to it over days or weeks. It's a Wampanoag tradition, and an indigenous-led education coalition called the Wampanoag Experience invites other tribes and non-indigenous people to participate with experiences like this Mishoon burn. Andre, the guest on this show, runs an organization called No Loose Braids and collaborates with the Wampanoag Experience.
Good afternoon. My name is Andre Strong Bearheart. I'm from the Nipmuc people. It's a tribe out of Massachusetts. And I am the creative director of No Loose Braids, which is our nonprofit that focuses on cultural revitalization, cultural preservation, also land stewardship, and workshops. These workshops that go throughout our tribe and our sister tribes' communities to create that cultural continuity and continuously keeping these practices that we've done for thousands of years here alive.
Can you tell me about how these cultural traditions connect to water?
As a Nipmuc person, Nipmuc means freshwater people. Nipi, that's how we say water, you know. We also know that water is our first medicine, and not just us. I mean, it's everybody's medicine. When it comes to water and the connection with our people, we are paddle community too, you know. When we burn out machines, which is a dugout canoe, when we fall trees and burn them out, these were our vessels to travel in. We didn't have horses. We were paddle community, and so we had paddle songs. We would paddle into each other's communities and greet each other. Also, when it comes to water, our drums, our water drums, you know, all the way up in Penobscot territory, all the way down into Long Island and Montauk, Shinnecock area, we share all these social songs, and they're played on water drums and with rattles.
What do you mean when you say a water drum?
Well, it's basically a tree that comes down, and we burn it out just like we're burning out a Mishoon.
Oh, cool.
And so it's hollow in the middle, but not completely hollowed out. Yeah. And a piece of skin goes over that, and there's water added into it to tune it, and that's how we sing our songs, our traditional songs.
Oh, cool. So you actually put water in the drum.
Yes. The water wakes it up, yes.
Oh, that's amazing. Wow, I would love to hear how that impacts the sound.
Yeah, it's a beautiful sound.
The value of water goes beyond the physical and has this rich cultural prevalence around the world. The presence of water has a huge impact on the food people eat and in turn the food traditions that go with culturally significant foods. But it's hard when the climate is changing and getting more unpredictable. Changes to the season, droughts, floods, all of this can make it harder to grow and forage foods if, for example, what you're used to harvesting can't live or grow in the new conditions. Preparing for whatever Mother Nature throws at you is one of the many struggles that farmers face, and climate change is making it impossible in many places that really are centered around agriculture. There were a lot of wild weather events this summer, And just after I met Andre, there was a massive storm just north of where we met in the northeast of the US, and farmers were hit hard. I saw a video of a woman standing knee-deep in flood water on a farm road to show people how bad it was. Her name is Grace O'Dell, and she's the executive director of the Northeast Organic Farming Association of Vermont. She's working to get farmers impacted by the storm grants to help with the damages.
So early, I guess it was just beginning of last week, feels like a lifetime ago, we had an unexpected flooding event that resulted in what, you know, people like to talk about 100-year floods that now we experience every few years. Or, you know, Hurricane Irene was 12 years ago. We've had another major flooding event in between Hurricane Irene and this event, we call the Halloween flood. And now this is definitely the earliest in the season we've had a flooding event of this scale and magnitude. And it's been even more devastating than Irene. We had a lot. We've done 100 intake forms with farms who have really intense impact. And there are more that we just haven't connected with yet. And we, you know, whole farms were underwater, entire crops lost, a lot of capital and infrastructure gone, tractors underwater. There's a, you know, major, in the short term, there's just like major questions about people losing their jobs for the season, folks who are relying on food, and also long-term questions about just how do we rebuild from an event like this when floods are more and more intense and more common. So we've been doing a lot of direct response work. You know, we've called a lot of our farmers, we've gone to a lot of farms, we're helping people assess what their next steps could be. We're doing a lot of fundraising and making emergency grants. Yeah, we've pivoted, you know. This is where organizations and people being organized is really, really helpful because we can respond more quickly than the government. So that's good.
Yeah, you have all these branches and programs that have their own networks working all the time. And then when something like this happens, you're all connected.
Totally, yeah.
I don't know if people realize how something like even just touching water or being underwater, I mean, whole fields, you can't use that anymore. It's gone. And especially at the height of the season, I mean, farmers invest all year to make these concentrated profits.
Exactly. Yeah, that's part of the issue. It came right at the time of the season where farmers, unless you're on a CSA model or something where people pay you in the beginning of the season, you haven't gotten most of your harvest and most of your payment. And so mostly, yeah, most farmers go into debt, and by July they're in debt to, you know, plant and put the soil amendments that they need and, you know, get everything going. And then they get paid towards the end of the season when they have crop to sell. And so part of the issue is, yeah, exactly. Any of the food that touched floodwaters can't be sold. It's not food safe. And a lot of the water isn't food safe. A lot of us are on boil water notice still. You know, there's an incredible amount of runoff. Septic systems were not at all equipped to handle this. There's a ton of municipal overflow. Whole towns were underwater. There's a ton of just debris still in our capital of Montpelier, just in the road. People gutted their basements or their floors of their house themselves because there was no quick flood response teams. And then all of that was sitting out when more rain came. And then all of that runoff is in the water. And then that water is on the fields. So it's a systems problem. It's an all of us problem. There's runoff issues all the time, but they're way more acute right now. And like, you know, we're also experiencing wildfire smoke from Canada. And it's really clear, like, we're all connected in this system. There's no one who can escape climate crisis. We need to address it together because it's affecting everyone. And while it's impacting Vermont acutely right now, it's also affecting people all over the globe with record heat and drought some places, but other places. And we're just at one of, you know, all too many epicenters of climate chaos. What we have is that we are very resilient in so far as we are a strong community and people know each other. There's not a lot of people. There's 600,000 people in the state of Vermont. a lot of those people know each other and they're helping each other. The people I see donating, we have an emergency fund. We've raised almost $500,000 and we're just giving it straight back out as emergency grants. And like so many of the names are, you know, other farmers, community members, some donors, some people from farther away who are sending us checks and saying like solidarity from Virginia. And a lot of that sense of community, like we're the ones who are going to get us through, is really coming through. And that feels really, really good. And, you know, the lack of a coordinated federal response is really, really challenging. FEMA funding just became available for Vermonters, but it is not available for farmers. All of the relief money that's going to come to farmers is going to do so through the USDA, the Farm Service Agency. But the Farm Service Agency funding is through programs. You know, you have to be enrolled in a program to get funded back. So that includes things like crop insurance. But crop insurance, the way that crop insurance works is per acre, per crop type. So it works very well for mega industrial farms that have thousands of acres of one type of crop. So I think, you know, community resilience is something I think all communities need to be really investing in. Like, what's your plan? What's your community resilience plan? Do you really know your neighbors? Do you really know how to show up for each other? Have you practiced?
Community resilience is a term you've probably heard, but let's unpack it. What do you think about when you think about community? Maybe you think about your neighbors or your family or friends. Community makes me think about support and connection. Typically, we think about community relating to physical proximity, but it can be formed by things that have more to do with what we have in common, things that make us feel emotionally connected. What about resilience? I think about strength both in withstanding adversity and also recovering from it. When we put them together, you have a community with strength and grit. We may not be able to stop bad things from happening, but we can figure out how to better prepare and how to recover through community resilience. While the Northeast was dealing with the aftermath of the storm this summer, on the other side of the country, farmers are navigating how to deal with drought and extreme heat. Reina Bentia is a farmer I met through a mutual friend in New Mexico. She's from the Zuni Pueblo, about 150 miles west of Albuquerque. The Southwest is somewhere water conservation matters a lot. I asked Reina about how farmers in her area interact with the environment.
Well, I think farmers, especially like small scale farmers, they're really intuitive about how the environment affects the farming aspect of it, because like we're always trying to listen for different pests that are on the way, different things that have to do with climate change. Like when we receive water, always kind of looking out for the environment around us because it impacts the growing season. And especially here, like in the Southwest, we have the monsoon rains that are supposed to be starting right now, and it feels like a little late in the season. So any of our irrigation that we do by flooding comes from the upper watershed. So being mindful of snowpack and how much runoff we're receiving for the spring and summer is really important, because like last summertime we had like a river that completely dried up. And so that was like pretty hard because it affects not just the farming aspect, but like the whole Rio Grande watershed and the river and all the animals and things that it provides for. So I think for people that depend on the water in the Southwest, it's like especially important for the farmers to like advocate for the water rights and the water resources that we depend on. It's really tied to helping out our natural environment. And it's important to, yeah, just be aware of who's using the water and who might be contaminating it as well. We have lack of water resources here. So I think one of the key things is just making sure it's protected.
While I was in New Mexico interviewing farmers and spending some time with my aunt that lives there, I learned about one of the ways New Mexico's water is managed. It's called an acequia. You might remember Ron Boyd from the special episode I did about seeds. Well, here he is explaining what an acequia is.
This acequia This is a part of a land grant, and the land grant is initiated in 1698. And by 1712, the land grant is granted. And that land grant was 55,000 acres from the Ambudo River to the Santa Cruz River, that's Chimayo, and from the Sierras to the Rio. 55,000 acres.
Wow. And can you describe it for people that can't see it? Like, what does an acequia look like?
Well, in our case, I mean, our acequia is 3 foot deep, and in place it runs from 10 to 14 foot wide. Later in the summer, we will have half of the Rio in our acequia. Wow. So to many people, you know, you'd call it a canal. Because it's that big. I mean, you could actually put inner tubes on here and float down the acequia.
Have you ever done that?
No, I haven't. I mean, on the Rio, but I mean, actually, we had some friends here recently, and they did. They put tubes on here. I never thought of putting tubes in.
I mean, it's gorgeous right there. I want to do it right now.
Well, it is a nice fresh dip. It flows from about middle of March to, just after Thanksgiving. And it's the primary source of irrigation. I mean, some people are depending on wells, but for us, everything below the acequia is flood irrigated off of the acequia. Yeah.
Wow, it's beautiful. We got back in the cart that we've been driving around in, and we went over to take a look.
Let's see, I guess we should also say that the acequia, this acequia, is owned by the Parciantes. I mean, by the people who participate. The Parciantes. We pay, you know, acequia fees just for the mayordomo who, you know, is the governor of the acequia.
Oh, wow, you have a governor of the acequia.
Pardon me?
You have a governor just of the acequia.
More or less, yeah. And he's appointed by the commissioners, and the commissioners are voted in by the people. So it's really owned by the people. In many places, you know, the water systems are owned by private companies, privatized. I mean, in many, many places, you know, the water is metered, and it's getting more and more and more controlled. Mm-hmm. But in northern New Mexico, well, on this one, I mean, we have the most abundant water type, well, in New Mexico.
Wow. Access to water for farmers doesn't just impact their crops. It also impacts their own food security as well. I connected with a nonprofit organization called El Porvenir that works in Nicaragua to improve water access in remote parts of the country.
First, we have four programs inside the organization. We have water, we have sanitation, we have an education program, and we have a watershed program.
That's Clara Sandino, the program supervisor speaking with me from Nicaragua. The idea of these programs is that once they're set up, they have representatives from the community to keep them going, so the organization can move to the next project in a new area. The watershed restoration work is what initially got my attention, because it works directly with farmers. But I quickly learned from Clara that access to clean water was promoting food security in a number of other ways as well.
So we have an example, very, very beautiful example, with a woman that lives in a municipality in the center of our country. And she is like the representing woman in the community, and shared with us that when she didn't get the system, the water system, she had to walk 3 kilometers to get the water with their kids. And now she's very happy because she has the spot of water inside the house. And we have videos, the pictures of them before and after. And now she had like a small tienda.
Like a store.
Yeah. In the community, she used her time now not to get the water 3 kilometers. She used her time to sell products in her house, and now she has like a small, how can you say, a gallinero.
Oh, like a little farm.
Yes, she has a farm, and she have lands, and this is like an iconic situation that we have. You can see what we are doing that is very important, and you have the results in the field.
Clara explained that although there are these really exciting success stories where you can see the impact from 1 year to the next, not all of their projects work that fast. For example, the watershed restoration work they do takes years until you can see the difference.
We in Nicaragua, we have just two seasons. We have winter and we have summer. So summer is from November to April, and winter is from May to October. But now we have a very, how do you say, dry May. You know, if you don't have rain, you don't have produce, you don't have vegetable, you don't have corn, you don't have beans, rice in the time that you are expecting. So one of the things that we are doing is that maybe we have to see what plants are more resistant to the dry season, okay? And another thing that is very important to us is that all the indicators in watershed programs are very slowly to get it. It's not like a water system that we have in 3 months. This result, it's not from 1 year to another year. It's take a lot of time. And it's very difficult to the farmer to explain it, because the farmer also wants the result in the same, maybe in the same time, in the same year. And so we are trying to do like, well, in Spanish we call it obras de conservación de suelo y agua. That in English is like activity to conserve water and soil. So this is like a paper that we can sign with them, and they are like get a compromise to do all this activity in this farm, okay? But also we give them incentivos.
Yeah, incentives.
Yes. So it's like win and win. I don't know how to explain it, but a win-win. Yeah.
And that's really important. I don't know if people always understand the trade-offs that exist for farmers that are transitioning to more sustainable practices. It's hard to make decisions that will benefit you and the community 5-10 years down the road when you're worried about feeding your family this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's not always easy, because some farmers don't want to work with us. They don't understand some things that you already said about the change we are going to see 5-10 years.
El Porvenir wants the difference they make in these communities to last. And they understand the most sustainable development is through projects that are community-led.
We, like organization, we are now in the community, doing a lot of training, talking with the farmers, trying to do things that could be more sustainable, our project, but we are living too. We are like in 5 years in the community, in the municipality, and we are going out because we have to go to another places that they need water. And after that, all the projects are in the community, so the community have to be responsible to the sustainability about this project and to have more water in their source.
When it comes to our food system, water considerations will have to be at the forefront of transitioning to a sustainable food system. How and what we grow in this changing climate will also have to change. It's September 2023, and since I started writing out what I wanted to say on this episode, we've had so many storms around the world, including the one in Libya where thousands have died. But just because things have gotten bad does not mean they can't get worse, and they will if we don't reduce our global emissions. To deal with a new climate reality and to stop it from getting to the point of no return, there's so many ideas and potential solutions, and it can be hard to know what holds the most promise. Which are sustainable solutions and which could have unforeseen consequences in the future? The truth is, we don't always know. A process I've gotten used to using is determining, is this community-led? Who are the potential winners and losers of this so-called solution? The focus of this episode may be water, but the overarching theme is community building. Strong communities are what make us resilient and how we create change. And that's where we'll find the most creative and equitable solutions. To learn more about all the community building work the guests on this episode do, please check out their social media and website information in the description. You can also find them through my page on Instagram @thefarmersIKnow. Thank you so much for listening.